hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Sophia Banzov, an actor and filmmaker you might recognize from movies like Closet Monster, Splinters, and Honeybee, or from her appearances in Bitten, Rain, Carter, and Murdoch Mysteries. She played a key role in Nicole Dorsey's haunting drama Black Conflux, which premiered at TIFF last fall, and at the same festival, you could see Sophia's own short film, I Am in the World as Free and Slender as a Deer on a Plane. Both titles were named to Canada's Top 10 in December, and I Am in the World screens with four other Top 10 shorts this Sunday, January 26th, at 4 p.m. at the TIFF Bell Lightbox in Toronto. Sophia picked The Canyons, Paul Schrader's 2013 study of Los Angeles discontentment, starring Lindsay Lohan and James Dean as film industry habitués whose relationship is complicated when she convinces him to cast her ex as the lead in his new horror project, without telling him he's her ex, which leads to all sorts of emotional and practical entanglements. Perhaps more famous for the stories of its chaotic production than for its own accomplishments, The Canyons had a very short theatrical run and now exists as a sort of phantom. It's not available on streaming services, so unless you can find the DVD or Blu-ray, there's no way to see it. Which just makes it more alluring somehow. This is someone else's movie.
Well, first of all, I'm just so excited to be talking about it with somebody.
Sure.
Because I feel like it's one of those movies that I've been loving for many years and haven't really ever found somebody who, like, shares that love for the movie with me. I mean, first of all, like, the people involved, Paul Schrader, Brad Easton Ellis, Lindsay Lohan, James Dean.
Yeah.
It's already such an insane grouping of individuals that, you know, by itself should already, like, sort of cement it as cult status.
Mm-hmm. But it's sort of disappeared, hasn't it? Like, I was looking and I can't find it anywhere. I've seen it. Mm. The discs are still floating around in the world, but mm-hmm. as far as I can tell, it's not even, unless I missed it, it's not even on iTunes right now.
It's not.
Okay.
Yeah. I illegally downloaded it.
No. Paul Schrader listens to this.
I mean, I couldn't find, in fact...
Was that how you first saw it?
Well, it came, so first of all, the New York Times Magazine article
right.
came out in 2013, I think.
Yeah, it was like 6 months before the film came out?
Yeah, I think so. So that, I read that and I was like, sounds incredible, I must see this. Then it had a really limited release at the Lightbox.
Okay. I thought it played the... No, that's right. There was an event at the Royal, right, with the Seventh Art.
About the... Oh,
really? Schrader came out and he showed a clip or the trailer. The film wasn't finished.
Right.
But it was that year.
Right.
Because I interviewed him for it.
That's right. You told me,
And they were screening the restoration of Taxi Driver, but they used it as a tease for The Canyons.
Right.
And that would have been in the spring. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, in August, the film finally surfaced for a tiny, tiny run.
But so I didn't see it when it came out.
Okay.
I read the article. I was like, I gotta watch this. Then it came out. I didn't have a single person to watch it with. And then I was like, it just kind of passed me by. I kind of lost interest and then it disappeared. And then a year later, I was like, oh, I remember that weird movie with James Dean and Lindsay Lohan. I wonder where I can find that. And then I watched it alone in my room on my laptop. And... within the first 5 minutes, I just knew that I loved it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it the montage of empty, desiccated theaters?
Well, no, actually, right after the montage. And the first scene is that scene where you see Lindsay Lohan wearing that insane makeup.
Right.
And, you know, for me, I kind of, like, grew up with her in a way. Like, she's a bit older than me, but she broke out of her, like, good girl facade around the same time as I did.
Okay.
As a teenager. It was like the era of, you know, Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen just smoking, you know.
Oh, right.
Those tabloid shots of them like smoking at street corners and like looking haggard and...
Right. The late 2000s where it all went to hell.
Yeah. Those were my idols.
Right.
You know, I started dressing in rags, like wearing... crazy eyeliner and so I think to some degree like I already had this love for her and I wanted to see her thrive and I wanted to see her be embraced for this like person that she had become, which is to say somebody who's like very unlike that sort of teen idol, you know, Mean Girls type of
right
virgin person.
I mean, it's true. It sounds weird now to articulate it, but she was the Courtney Love of her generation, right? Like, when it went, it went.
Yeah.
And she just, I guess Courtney Love never really had a squeaky clean phase, but...
Yeah, no, she went through that baby doll thing, but it was, that was not squeaky clean either. Just playing with...
But Lohan sort of severs ties with Disney and completely grows up in the space of 30 minutes in the public eye. It felt like. I mean, it wasn't a Britney-level self-destruction, but she was certainly, like, she wasn't that person anymore and didn't want to be that person anymore. It was a conscious choice.
Yeah, it was a slow but steady descent, unlike Britney, which was just like, you know, suddenly she shaves her head and we all love it.
Yeah, like Mean Girls, I'm trying to figure this out. Mean Girls is like 2003, 2004, right? And I Know Who Killed Me is 2007.
Right.
I remember that clearly.
And then she did...
But by then it was already happening.
Yeah, totally.
And so here she is 6-7 years later.
Well, she did a couple of movies between then that were kind of bit parts. She had like a small part in Bobby
Kennedy. Oh, that's right, the Estevez film.
Yeah, and actually, I thought she was great in that. And then she had another... She did something else. Well, she did Prairie Home Companion. And then... Oh, of course, the Elizabeth Taylor biopic.
Oh, that's right.
The Lifetime
TV movie. I forgot about that one.
Which I thought she was amazing in.
I don't know that I've seen it, actually.
It's worth watching.
Okay. Well, she is... This is the frustrating thing about any... actor who goes through the uncomfortable self-destructive phase, like, you are compelled to follow this person because they've already proven themselves to be a really interesting presence, right? And I just, I mean, I remember watching Herbie Fully Loaded because I had to review it and thinking, she's better than this.
Yeah.
And she knows this. You can see it in the performance. Like, she's sort of trying, but she knows she shouldn't be there.
Right.
And then she starts acting out and she starts taking charge of her own destiny, which is kind of played as acting out, because that's how you handle this. Like, everybody wants to force the story into an existing box, right?
Totally.
And then she shows up in movies where it's genuinely, it's not a provocation. She's doing this because she wants to. But something like The Canyons is in conversation with her entire history, right? Like, I mean, Schrader said she had a Marilyn Monroe quality and that he wanted to exploit, but also enable it. And all of a sudden, I mean, the only thing I remember about The Canyons is thinking, oh, she still got it. And whatever it is really interesting.
Yeah, she's fascinating because she, as a person, seems like she has no self-awareness. And whenever you see an actor that has, like, lost their personhood to celebrity or, like, you know, just the circumstances of their lives. And I think she's a person that... I mean, she must have insane stories because she came of age in an era that,
I assume,
you know, just, I'm sure, like, some fucked up things have happened to her. But then to have this, like, lack of self-awareness and then still watch her have, like, a full grasp on her emotions in performance that's so compelling is fascinating.
Yeah, and this film... more than almost anything else I'd seen her do before, is about watching her.
Yes.
Like, it's about looking at her and letting her indicate whatever it is she wants to indicate or not. And it's, you know, the whole Paul Schrader thing, like American Gigolo, like Light Sleeper, you're watching people withhold from the camera. And she's really good at that. Or she's giving out nothing and we are assuming that she's really good at it. But I think it's conscious. I think it's a directed performance that... is what Schrader wants and is what she wants to do.
Yeah, it seems like a performance that converges her person and the character perfectly. And I felt that from the first frame, that this was finally a movie that, like, embraced her, where she could thrive as the person she had become. And, it, you know, I felt like there was a lot from her personal life that really meshed well with that character. You know, her, the whole movie, she's sort of... navigate. I mean, everyone in that movie is constantly performing. They're all telling lies, and they're all amazing at telling lies. And you're watching her try to decide between how to manipulate the people around her constantly, like whether through vulnerability or through, you know, coldness. And in that movie, it's like the only thing that separates all the lies from the truth is just how well you deliver it.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's true of her personal life. I mean, again, I don't know her, but like just watching her in interviews and stuff, that like you just know that she's lying, but she's lying so well that you're like, okay, I guess I'll take it, but I know you're full of shit.
Right. Is she doing it to protect herself? Is she doing it just to string people along? I mean, in the interviews, because I've never been able to really understand the read there. I've never met her or interviewed her either. But as in the, you know, it's a Herbie Fully Loaded situation. She somehow lets you know what she means, even if she doesn't mean it.
I think she doesn't know the difference.
Yeah.
I think at that point you're so deep and you don't know the difference between the truth and something you've made up. And I think it's just your whim of the day, like, mm-hmm. What am I gonna reveal? I don't feel like revealing that. No, I've never smoked this. It's true in that moment for her.
Right. So you're just flowing.
Yeah.
Like you're in the moment, and whatever happens, happens.
That's what I think. I think, and her energy is just so. You know, I was reading that New York Times Magazine piece again, and the journalist keeps saying that she's just, there's such a manic, like, chaotic quality about her, like. Every room she enters immediately starts falling into disarray. And she, and her, I think he was saying that her, what he felt like from her, or maybe it was Schrader that said this, that she cannot be alone, that she's constantly like looking for people to surround herself with so as to not like be with herself.
Right.
And I think part of that is like having to confront the truth of your life. And when you're with other people, you can just pick out a version of who you want to be and like roll. But when you're alone, you can no longer really deny that.
Sure. The easiest way to avoid thinking about the wreckage you've left behind is to make more wreckage.
Mm-hmm, right? Totally.
Just keep churning forward.
Yeah.
And the idea too that she's playing someone who by the time we meet her is used up.
Mm-hmm.
Like she's already, her character in the canyons is a husk, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, she's already finished as whatever it is she wanted to be, and now she's just this sort of girlfriend / companion of James Dean's character,
yeah.
Who is maybe just a recycling of Patrick Bateman because Bret Easton Ellis is comfortable there, but he's clearly a charming sociopath, somebody who gets what he wants by just not listening to what other people tell him and
mm-hmm.
never taking no for an answer.
Mm-hmm.
So she sets him up with her ex for a movie role, and then that reignites their relationship, sort of, kind of, but everybody is just sort of casually using everybody else. I don't know if anything happens out of pure desire or just convenience. Like, it's a way to pass the time.
Well, she says in the movie, her character Tara says to Ryan when they're meeting in that horrible mall.
That's right. So much of this movie is, like, it does feel like California to me.
Totally. It feels like that new Hollywood that, like, every location. I mean, the Malibu house is amazing, but that mall and the like West Hollywood house and all those places just seem so bleak.
Yeah.
But she says to him, you know, nobody's happy. What do you even mean? Am I happy? There's no such thing. And I feel like that's true of every, like all the characters in that film. No one's really like, there's an idea of happiness that they're pursuing. Like, oh, I want to be an actor. I want to, you know, I want to win this role because then that'll lead to A, B, and C. But
right.
Really nobody is enjoying themselves.
Yeah, nothing, there is, it's, yeah, I mean, that's Bret Easton Ellis' specialty, right? Empty pursuits of pleasure,
yeah.
Or pursuits of empty pleasure, I'm not sure how it works, but yeah, you're in motion all the time, chasing the next high, and it's never as good as you need it to be, to
yeah.
Make you stop.
Yeah.
But here we also have, like, the temptation of celebrity, the lure of the movies, and it's stuff that, again, by the time we meet Tara, like, Lohan is done with it. She
mm-hmm.
was no longer interested in chasing an A-list role. She wanted to work with people like Schrader who would presumably challenge her and get something out of her she hadn't given before.
And then it's so interesting that she almost like totally kneecapped that movie.
Mm.
Like, you know, I think she was getting paid like $100 a day, I think.
Yeah, everyone made it for scale.
Right.
Right, and they raised the money on, for the most part, on Kickstarter,
right.
I think, and they contributed. I know Schrader and Ellis put their own money into it.
Yeah, so the producer, Ellis and Schrader each put $30,000 into it. And then...
Which is now enough to make a movie entirely.
Right, but, totally. Yeah. And then they raised, I think, like, almost $200,000 on Kickstarter. One of the perks was for $3,000, you could spend a week working out with Bret Easton Ellis and his trainer. Which seems more like a punishment than a perk.
Yeah, I'm sure someone would want that. But it's a status thing, right?
Like, yeah.
James Dean's character would buy that.
Right.
He would want that.
Totally.
And that, and he's... The fact that I can make jokes about the character, the guy has no... Dean has presence, weirdly enough. The character doesn't. The character is a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just trying to... I was trying to figure out whether it was almost a challenge for Schrader to cast that guy against someone like Lindsay Lohan, someone who... Because they both bring a huge history with them to this project. And Dean, obviously, he'd come out of... I don't know what the proper term is these days. Adult filmmaking, cinema, porn, whatever you want to call it. He wasn't known for his acting. He was known for a different sort of performance. And so...
I tend to differ there.
Okay, please, yeah.
Well, I actually think that James Dean is an amazing actor. I think he has a very magnetic presence. I think that his adult films, the thing that they've got going for them is his... I don't want to say acting, because that's not really what I mean, but he is able to... conjure a feeling of intimacy in his porn that is super rare, I find. And I think that's why he has such a huge fan base of, you know, mostly adolescent girls. You know, Tumblr is just packed with, with James Dean. Yeah, I mean, really, I'm talking like teenage girls. And, you know, there's all these Tumblr pages of GIFs of him, like, kissing a girl, like, just, and it's not like the, I mean, there are definitely people that are fans of, like, the hardcore stuff, but I think where he has found his base is with how he, you know, creates this this feeling of intimacy with another person. And that's really hard to do as a performer, and to be able to do that within, I don't know, 30 minutes of meeting somebody, you have to have something. There has to be something special about you if you're able to create that.
Yeah, I have to admit, I was completely ignorant of him until, or before the Canyons.
Yeah.
I knew who he was, but I always sound like such a weird, crotchety old man when I say this. I don't watch porn.
Yeah.
I can't stand it. I find it, all I do is look at the lighting, and ever since HD came in, it made it even worse. I can't enjoy, even the aesthetic of the stuff just doesn't do it for me, because I just keep thinking, this looks
why
so uncomfortable, and it's hacky, and I mean, Boogie Nights captured the thing that I can't stand perfectly, which is the self-conscious acting and the lack of physical presence. So I guess that's it. My own prejudice is that it's just like, you can't be good if you came from there, but that's not fair.
I get that. And also, you know, I mean, God, I'm not like, I don't love porn, but I love James Dean and I like his porn. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly not like, I certainly don't watch it for like the artistic.
Right.
And I had to really let go of that, because for a while I was like, why doesn't this fucking look better? It's so easy to make something look good these days. Mm. Why does it all look like shit?
That's what I mean. It has to be, I want, if I'm watching anything, I want someone to have cared about it.
Totally.
And it sounds so square.
But I understand. But I think with Dean, it's like, when you're watching it, there does seem to be, like, he is the person that brings the care to the set. And that's why I love him. And I mean, that concern about the type of acting that happens in porn films, like, that was, that was Bret Easton Ellis' concern. Like, he didn't want him to be cast.
Oh, really?
For that reason. So he was like, you know, I think it was Ellis that said no, or that didn't want it initially. Because it's just like, he thought that it wouldn't be possible to break him out of that style of acting. But I think he's really strong in the Canyons, and I've been thinking about American Gigolo, and how, like, Richard Gere he's just not that good.
Yeah.
And when you're watching that movie, you just want him to just have more charm, or, like, it's such a male gaze movie where you're like, none of these women would fall for this guy. Like, he is maybe good looking, but he has, like, for an escort, he has just an astounding lack of charm. And I kept imagining James Dean in that part, and okay. I was like, I would buy that.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's what appeals to him for Schrader, mm-hmm. is the unreadability, but the empty charisma, I guess, mm-hmm. of the character, right. not of Dean himself.
Right.
But, yeah, American Gigolo is one of those fascinating movies that it says so much about where Schrader was as a filmmaker, and, you know, coming right after almost right after Taxi Driver, it's just like another movie about God's Lonely Man and this person who is isolated from the world that he lives in and operates in. And I get why he cast Gear, because at that time the guy was white hot. He was an unstoppable force. And I could force myself to believe that, oh, no, they want him because he looks like Richard Gere, not because of any other quality about himself. And then it kind of plays for the film. If the guy's a void, then it works. But you're right. He is lacking in something that would make him a credible version of that character.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it took a long time before people figured out that Gere is at his best when you ask him to play an empty suit.
Right.
Like, when he's in on his own joke.
Right. But in that movie, he was supposed to have, like, dimensions. Mm-hmm.
We're supposed to care about him.
Yeah, and there were two dimensions to him, and that was it. Like, he could play one or two things, but never, like, the nuance of it. And, actually, I think Ellis did want Dean for the part, because now I'm remembering that he wanted to write the script for 50 Shades, and he wanted to cast, or he wanted to write it for James Dean. And I thought that was just brilliant. Because I've watched 50 Shades, and there's just, like, no chemistry between these two people. Well,
that movie's afraid of sex.
It's afraid of sex.
That whole trilogy is afraid of sex. It's a really creepy...
How do you make a movie about sex without being terrified of it?
Yeah. It's awkward. I like the sequels a little bit more because James Foley made them, and he at least understands the concept of tension. And
right.
It's not that Sam Taylor Wood is a bad filmmaker. I think she's a really fascinating artist, but the combination of the material and having E.L. James involved and just saying, well, I want it this way, you can just feel everybody hobbled from the beginning.
Exactly. You can feel everybody, and you can feel the hand of the studio, and you can just feel that it's never going to work out from the beginning because they want to cast these sterile people who have nothing in common. Yeah. And I was just picturing James Dean in that part and how, you know, it would be appeal to me.
Well, certainly based on the Canyons, I could see him playing someone who is withholding and you know, the whole point of Christian Grey is that he won't love.
Right.
You know, like he wants a marriage contract and all this stuff, but he's all doing it because of the defenses he's built up for himself. And if you have someone like Dean who can be impenetrable based on the Canyons anyway, that works.
Totally.
Somebody and then you still want have to get to.
And then still have this like possibility of violence.
You know? That's true. There's really no tension in the first 50 Shades anyway, just because, everybody's just trying to be photogenic. I mean, I don't know how to explain it, but it sounded like that entire production is a battle between what the material demands, which is just kind of lurid overkill and make it as purple as possible and just let people have fun with it. And that's where Dakota Johnson could have worked, because she's got amazing comic presence. Like, I have loved her since Ben and Kate, this completely forgotten one season and done, not even finished, Fox show with her and Nat Faxon, where she is just this amazing screwball presence who's also funny and sexy and everything else. But when she landed this, it's just like, oh, that could go very badly.
Flattened.
Yeah, exactly. It's just been, I'm making a rolling pin impression with my hands. It's just been ground down.
Yeah.
Steamrolled, if you will.
But yeah.
Yeah. And just Eric Johnson has some fun with it in the sequels, because he's that actor who's just like, well, you know, I get to be larger than life. I'm playing a character named Hyde. What the hell? Right. But
even still, like with the Canyons, you know, there are so many performances. In fact, most of the performances in that movie are quite bad.
Yeah.
You know, all the peripheral, like, actors are sort of shockingly bad. I mean, it's sort of like you're going into acting class and you're seeing these people not improve week after week.
Oh, I see, yeah.
That's the feeling I had when I was watching it. I was like, oh, this is... How did they get cast? And, but it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't... like, because you have James Dean and you have Lindsay Lohan who sell it overall, and the rest of the performances in some ways, like, it almost is irrelevant that they're bad.
Yeah. Well, it creates a sort of tone, right? Like, this sort of disaffected scenester thing that Dean and Lohan have going on.
Mm-hmm.
If the world around them is so flat, then it makes sense that they'd be like this, right?
Right.
It feels like a conscious attempt to create the environment. I don't know that it is. I think you're right. I think they're just bad performances. But it's who you get to make a movie on the cheap, right? Like, it's not like they had... I get the sense that it's the casting pool that was available to them because they weren't going to pay particularly well, and this whole thing is being done on the fly.
Well, I've been thinking about that a lot, and just how much of it is self-aware. And I think there are, unfortunately, you know, the people that want to declare it like a self-aware masterpiece, I think, are a bit off track.
Mm.
I think it's a masterpiece, but I don't think it's self-aware. I think, to some degree it is, but I certainly think that, like, they didn't want flat performances. The main thing that snags for me is that, and I don't know if people come on here choosing movie like like tearing it apart, but I do love it.
Sure.
But there's one thing about it that I think is its fatal flaw, which is that it looks like shit.
Mm.
And I looked up the cinematographer's filmography, and there's just absolutely no evidence of anything that he made that would make Paul Schrader want to hire him, in my opinion. Like, he made a bunch of shorts. He made one really cheap-looking thriller, and then he made a bunch more shorts, which is fine, but, like, he was middle-aged at that point, and...
Why? He's not like an up-and-coming guy.
No, he was not an up-and-coming guy. He was not like a hungry guy. He was not somebody who seemed even up-to-date in terms of like technology, because it's 2013. Like, a lot has changed since then in terms of like what we have access to with a lower budget. But still, there's a way to make that movie look a lot better than it does.
Yeah, it has a pretty ugly digital look.
Yeah.
Like, not HD, but not great either. And the tech was there. Yeah, you're right.
The tech was there. The tech was there. They could have made it look much more expensive. Yeah, I don't know. There just seems to be, even just the way that he framed shots, that you don't need money for that. You just need to know how to frame a shot.
Yeah.
And he just puts people against like a blank wall.
Oh, yeah, that's right. There's a lot of that.
There's no depth.
Is it isolation? Is it the less than zero thing where you're just trying to literally show people being alone in a world? But
I wish it was.
Yeah, no, I want to make it make sense.
I wish it was. And I kept being like, well, they didn't have money and they didn't have time. But that's not really an excuse anymore. You can do great things with no money and no time, and you just move the furniture around and you don't frame people against a white wall with, like, I don't know. It just seems...
Yeah.
Shocking to me. And then also there are these more ambitious shots of just like, oh, you're like, oh, they got a dolly track for the day. That's good for them.
Right.
And even those shots are just, I don't know if you remember this part. It's when Christian comes home to the Malibu house and he's about to confront Tara about Ryan. And there's this long dolly shot of him coming through the driveway, walking through the house.
Yeah, I do remember that, yeah.
And the whole thing is, like, jerky. It's like jerky and bumping, and you're like, did they not rehearse this?
Yeah, it's that nervy handheld thing you do when you're trying to build tension, but...
But not on
purpose. You have to introduce it with intent.
Right, there's no intention there.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about this movie so much, and that's why I'm so fascinated by it, is because... You have Schrader, who, you know, God, like...
He's a veteran, yeah.
Yeah, like, and he just made these decisions that I can't fully comprehend, and yet by doing so, by the lack of intention, by the lack of thought behind it, something else emerges that I want to, like, grab onto and hold with both my hands, because it's, in some ways, it feels, like, more educational and, like, more truthful than a lot of more technically slick things.
Yeah, I mean, this is how I feel about who am I thinking? Cassavetes.
Mm-hmm.
And weirdly enough, I remember that Schrader had compared Loewen a number of times to Jenna Rollins.
Yeah.
Because of coming out the other side of the studio system and being the person she wanted to be, who, as he described it, was infinitely more interesting than the
right.
starlet version of herself. Cassavetes would do stuff to get a response from his actors. Mm-hmm. He would be difficult. He would be uncommunicative. He would also be incredibly collaborative and super friendly if that served his aim on the day. And every movie of his is this sort of glorious mess where you feel like you've stumbled through the wrong door and you're in the place you shouldn't be.
Yeah.
Like thinking of A Woman Under the Influence, which has these just incredible indulgent takes, which lead to something really, really powerful.
Yeah.
Because you just end up watching what someone's doing with their hands or what Peter Falk is doing with his hat, and you realize, oh, it's an anxiety or it's
yeah.
it's there for the story as much as it is for the performance. The Canyons feels like they're almost there a lot. I know exactly what you're saying, and I wonder if it isn't because they're waiting for Loewen to show up, and so when she gets there, mm-hmm. the energy is so hot and like, we got to get it now, we got to yeah. do this quickly. Although you would set up a shot, you'd have time to play with the lighting if that was going on.
Yeah, well, there was one moment when she showed up to set very disoriented, and I think probably some sort of drug was involved, and she missed all her marks. And so Schrader was like, let's do it handheld because she keeps missing her mark, and if you want us to shoot it like The Real Housewives, we're going to shoot it like The Real Housewives.
Really? Wow.
And that really struck me because I really love reality TV.
Okay.
And I'm a huge apologist for reality television. I think that it's dismissed wrongly. I think that it's like seen as this like trashy waste of time, guilty pleasure kind of thing. But I think that it has a lot of merit. And when he said that, I was like, oh, that, you know, that same... The Canyon speaks to the same part of me that, like, loves reality television. That, like, I just watched Temptation Island.
Okay, yeah.
I binged it. I loved it. And I was trying to figure out, like, what is it, first of all, that I love about reality TV? Because I had never really put it into, like, words before. And I actually haven't until, like, I am now about to.
Well, I mean, you're young enough that it's been around you all the time, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you've never known... It's a recent phenomenon from my perspective, but it's right. always been there.
Right? Yeah.
So it's a language you speak. You're a native speaker.
Right.
So, yeah, please.
Yeah. Well, I just think that, like, with narrative, traditional narrative, there's this sort of lie that we're being told, which is that this is the truth.
Okay.
And we're sold something... And we buy it as the truth, even though it's fiction. With reality TV, it's just like you're a little bit removed, but you're like, there's no lie in terms of like, these people are acting because there's a camera on them. And they are being changed by the camera as we're watching.
Okay, yeah.
So the presence of the camera changes everything. But in narrative cinema, we're being told that there is no camera. Like, there's no, you know what
right,
I mean?
Right,
there's
right.
no... So, in some ways, I feel like it's... In some ways, like, there's something more truthful about it, even though it's all performance. And these people in reality TV, they're acting... They're performing what they have seen on television.
Right.
They're performing what they've seen in porn. Like, they're performing dynamics that they're familiar with from narrative, you know, television or whatever. So, I don't know. I just find, like, it captures... something about being a person. I capture something about like the time we're living in a way that's just like a lot less like it's not filtered through this like hyper educated like white
yeah.
male like went to UCLA kind of like lens,
right? The
you
agreed
know?
Upon illusion of a narrative feature.
Exactly.
So I mean, that's pornography as well, right? That's
mm-hmm.
people pretending to be their best selves or a version of themselves that is sexier and hotter and
right.
give the audience what they want. So the Canyons kind of disappears that, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Because Dean is still sort of it's nothing he's doing, but the expectation of the audience is that I will see the James Dean that from that thing that I like.
Yeah.
Right? And Lohan is...
Lohan.
Performing, but incapable of... Yeah, she's she's incapable of not being herself, because yes. that's what makes her so interesting as a performer.
Exactly.
It's like Jessica Chastain. There's incredible range within a set of variables that remains the core somehow. I don't know how else to explain it, but there are moments where you sort of connect to the person rather than the persona, yeah. and it always pushes through in the best performances. And then everything else around them is so numb that yeah. we have nothing else to look at. So yeah. we're only looking at them.
And you're just hyper aware of the fact that they're acting in a movie written by Bret Easton Ellis, directed by Paul Schrader. And you know that, you know, 5 minutes before the sex scene, Lindsay Lohan was in the walk-in closet refusing to come out.
Okay.
So you know this because you read the article or whatever, and you just, there's a removal of that that fictional element.
Suspension of disbelief.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it brings you, even though it technically, like, should throw you out of the illusion, I feel like you get closer. I feel like the things that end up resonate stronger because of that.
Is it because, I mean, do you think it's because so much of Tara's character is about withholding and carrying pain that she won't acknowledge to people that we just assume it's Lohan's pain? Like, it's the same thing? It's, again, you said it, the combination of persona and performer. Yeah. Is that it? Like, you end up looking closer to see what hints you can find?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, regardless of, like, yeah, I think for sure. I mean, she's a wounded person, you can tell. And she definitely brings that into the character, and it feels resonant in a way that's uncomfortable because it feels true. And yes, and there's a removal of that suspension of disbelief, so you feel like you're closer and you're almost like looking at something you shouldn't be allowed to look at.
Yeah. It's the thing that Schrader can do, I think, too. I mean, it happens in First Reformed, and it happens in Light Sleeper and Affliction. These are movies about people who are in such torment
yeah.
that you don't want to look at them, and yet the whole point of the movie is to look at them.
Yeah.
And I honestly had not thought about the canyons that way until you brought it up, but it is the same thing, isn't it?
Right.
It's not a trapped animal. It's a life study.
Right.
But she's so young, and she's so... He's never really... Almost all of his protagonists are roughly him, right? They get older as the movie goes on, and the rare exceptions are things like Cat People, where Nastassja Kinski and Malcolm McDowell are sort of the two sides of whatever argument the film is having with itself.
Right.
And with the canyons, it did feel like a really uncharacteristic thing for him to be doing. And then I saw it, and I still didn't think it worked, but I got it. I understand, like, I know why he made this movie and what he's drawn to.
Right. Well, it's interesting because it's at such a interesting juncture of his career and Bret Easton Ellis' career, where they've really, just in some ways, like, all those shots of the cinemas, the dilapidated cinemas, in some ways, you know, they're saying cinema's dead and this is post-theatrical and, you know, but to me, that was a bit of a cop-out. I'm like, you're trying to rationalize the demise of your own career by saying that cinema is dead. And by, you know, and by... Like, I admire the fact that he was like, I'm just going to go out, do this as a Kickstarter project and, you know, make it for no money. But I feel like... I don't know. I feel like the lack of thought to some degree is a little bit, like, surprising.
You mean the impulse to just jump?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it could have very much been Old Man Yells at Cloud, right? Like, it's a... Yeah, it's the wasteland that they've been left to work in, I suppose. But, you know, Soderbergh makes those movies all the time. And
right.
They're in conversation with the changing technology and the way things are. And, yeah, The Canyons is really more about... I mean, they want to make a crappy horror movie to make a few bucks, and it's not like he hasn't done that. Mm-hmm. Schrader, anyway. But there's a... The thing that's missing from this movie that's in most of his other ones is, I think, the, like, is the curiosity about why people do what they do.
Yeah.
With this, it's just everything's a fait accompli. It's like, yeah, well, they're right. Gonna fuck each other over. Of course they are. What else is there to do?
And that might be Ellis's influence, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, definitely sounds like something he would say.
Yeah.
The cynicism and the lack of faith that they'll be able to get better, mm-hmm. that their situations might change, but the people won't improve. That's Ellis. Mm-hmm. No one ever really gets better in his books.
Right. Yeah. I really feel like it just narrowly missed that iconic that status of just like cult classic.
Yeah. It's weird that it didn't stick around. Part of that is probably just the way they released it, which was a quick dump into theatrical before VOD.
Yeah.
Which was always planned, because that's the fastest way to make your money back, apparently.
But they also got rejected, right, from all the... they got famously rejected by South By in a publicized way that I think was very painful.
Oh, yeah.
And Sundance. And then they played Venice, but out of competition.
Right, it had already been released by then, right? Because it opened here in the summer.
Right. So that's true.
So, yeah, it was just sort of a...
Right.
Not even a victory lap, but just a sort of a gentleman's agreement. Yes, of course. Please, you know, Mr. Schrader, please come. Won't you show us your film? Mm-hmm. I'm still struggling to quantify it even now, because there's stuff in it that is hooked me, that there are mm-hmm. things in it that I want to understand more, and I'll watch it again mm-hmm. At some point. I just don't know where it fits in the world, right? Because it feels like a relic
even
now.
I love that about it. I love that it doesn't have really a place to sit. I love that the elements are so incongruent, and I love that the sum of its parts doesn't totally ever get there. Like, that for me makes it so great. And then of course you have scenes that are just like in itself really strong, like despite the terrible cinematography. You know, I kind of had to learn to let go of that a little bit, because that really was the part that just, like, I couldn't handle. But, like, that, you know, that famous sex scene of the four-way.
Right.
I just love that scene, and I've never seen that dynamic play out in that way. Like, when she's... I don't know how recently you watched it.
It's been a couple of years, yeah.
Right. But she... You know, she asks Christian, her boyfriend, played by James Dean, to make out with this other guy.
Yep.
And then she asks, you know, she keeps pushing them to do things together. And I've just never seen that before. And how uncomfortable he gets, and how, you know, the next day he shows up to therapy and he's like, I felt like an actor.
Oh, that's right, because he lost control. I remember that. Like, it's so important to him to control people in every facet of his life that, again, you're right, he could have absolutely done 50 Shades of
Grey. He totally should have.
But yeah, that...
He's like, I felt objectified. And it's just such a perfect line, you know? It's just like... And then, in that same scene, she... Because they did it in one take.
I don't remember. Did they do that?
Well, it's cut.
Yeah,
but they said that they shot it. It was like a 14-minute take or something.
Okay.
Because it was like she was so uncomfortable, and that's before she locked herself in the closet. Schrader got naked. You remember reading that?
I do remember that, and I remember thinking that's. You hear stories about people doing that on sets, and I can't imagine it makes anyone any more comfortable.
I can't imagine either, but apparently she asked for it.
Okay, so
she asked for the entire crew to get naked, apparently. And everyone refused except for Schrader.
Well, good for him.
So he directed the scene naked.
I guess.
And then...
See, now my mind is just like, well, you'll know if it's working for him. I don't want to think about that.
I know.
I don't want to think about these
things. But there's a moment in that scene after she pushes James to get off, you know, by this other guy. He's super uncomfortable and she looks straight into the camera. Do you remember this?
No.
She breaks the fourth wall, she looks straight into the camera, and she smiles. And I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it. I just love that moment so much because it wasn't planned. She probably thought they would cut around it.
Mm-hmm.
They did not. It's this moment of, like, confronting us, watching Lindsay Lohan perform this part in which she has a four-way. She's, you know, it's, like, you can't... That's what I'm trying to get at when I'm saying, like, it feels more real and, like, it's it's like stripped down in that way where like you can't deny that you're watching this a movie, and
it makes you complicit.
Yeah, it makes you complicit. And also, she's telling us she knows.
Mm-hmm.
I know. I see you watching me.
Is it a positive moment, do you think? I mean, for you as a viewer?
It feels to me like an empowering moment for her. And so it's a positive experience for me as a viewer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really need to go back and watch it again. Yeah, this is one of those where I'm just like, damn it, I should have caught up again. I have to own that. I just didn't have time to find it.
Yeah, fair enough. But it's hard to find.
It's not, yeah. Blu-ray's got to be out there. I know I had it.
Yeah.
At some point.
You owned it?
Maybe it was, you know what? Maybe it was just a one of those digital streaming screeners that you can't hang on to. So many of those stupid things in the world where you just, here, watch our movie as though you had pirated it.
Right.
You know, like with an email address plastered across people's faces.
It's just like a piece of paper. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. They're the worst.
Right.
I'm pretty sure it would have been the service that Mongrel uses for their screeners, which is just, it's no good at all. It's just, I mean, we're in a room with a 120-inch screen and a projector, and the acrobatics required to get a film to play that way through a laptop into the receiver onto this, it's just, it looks like crap. And I have begged people to use better systems, but
yeah,
you know, the Vimeo app works with the Apple TV. It looks great.
Right.
But if anyone's listening, but yeah, no, I was not the optimal presentation for the Canyons, and I
get it.
Definitely saw it again. So I must have had the DVD or the Blu-ray at some point.
Right.
But I looked and I don't have it now.
I should really get my hands on a copy.
I wonder if someone borrowed it.
Yeah, I would just love to. I would love to. Yeah, because I really just have it. I just torrented it.
Blu-ray will be better.
Yeah.
I mean, it won't. It's not going to look gorgeous.
No.
That movie never will.
That movie will never look gorgeous. And in some ways, like, it's probably meant to be watched on a smaller screen.
Mm.
I think projected onto a big screen, you'd just be cringing the entire time.
Well, it's still part of the intention, right? I think it wants you to be uncomfortable.
That's the question that I can't answer.
Did he do it on purpose?
I feel like no.
Hmm.
I feel like that was the part where it wasn't intentional. I don't think the traitor's capable of saying, I want this movie to look like terrible. I don't think he would set out to do that. And I think it's actually an incredible sort of achievement that he was able to make it look so bad. Because it doesn't check out completely. Yeah.
No, you're right. He does play with form sometimes. I mean, First Reformed looks the way it does on purpose.
Yeah.
It's got this sort of liquid harshness to it.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know how else to describe it. He said it was just a setting that they showed him on the first day and he fell in love with. And I could sort of see make it look like what I think a bad movie looks like, but it doesn't feel like that either. Much of it has...
It's not intentional enough, even in its badness, that you can say, like, that was planned. You know? So it's... Yeah, it's surprising. So I feel like it's a movie that you could watch on your laptop and be, you know, content sort of watching it on a smaller screen.
Yeah, I wish I'd seen it in the theater now.
That would have been...
Maybe we'll get Tiff to do a Schrader retrospective and bring it back. If nothing else, just for, you know, there's a bunch of his movies that don't get screened often enough.
I actually am not super familiar, like, with, obviously I know the big movies, but I haven't seen Affliction, I haven't seen Lightwalker, Lightsleeper,
which is kind of the sequel to Taxi Driver in a way,
right?
In a weird way. It's Willem Dafoe is a drug runner who's just starting to age out of viability and kind of confronting who he is and who he thought he was going to be.
Right.
It's pretty intense. It's And it's one of those perfectly seamy New York movies shot on film in 1992 that just looks just grimy all over.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty good.
I mean, if I keep feeling like if the Canyons were shot on film, it would be so good.
Yeah. I think it'd be like underlit and weirdly timed.
It's so underlit.
Yeah.
The lighting is insane. Like, it's just, because I watched it again last night and it was just like, I couldn't, certain scenes were just, I didn't understand how anybody could let this fly.
Hmm.
James Dean's body lit from below his neck, his face completely in the shadows, not on purpose, 100% not on purpose. Yeah,
I remember, when I'm picturing it in my head, I picture only the stills that were circulated because I can't coherently assemble the movie in my brain.
What did you think of the soundtrack?
Oh, the Brendan Cannon soundtrack. I didn't mind. I mean, I think it works for a better movie. It makes you think the film has more depth than is currently present.
Mm.
It's kind of slippery and agitated in a way that I really like.
Mm-hmm.
It's not too far removed from, like, I don't know how it would sound on its own. It's one of those things where if you played it by itself, it might just be tones.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like it's yearning for something that it can't have, if
right.
that makes any sense. And maybe that's just coherence.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I mean, shout out to Brendan, because he's great. And I was watching it kind of thinking about what all the things that they could have done differently to have it maybe make more of an impact on the cultural psyche.
Right.
And the soundtrack was one of those things where I was like, I wonder what would have happened if they'd gone into like a completely different direction.
What would be appropriate? Well, what kind of score do you think that it calls for? I mean, you could do the De Palma thing and layer in a Baroque musical score where everything is so heightened and obviously like big and urgent and nervy. You could do pop songs from people who had faded away to maybe just disconnect the world a bit more. I don't know. There are ways, because the material is so amorphous that it could be tilted in the direction of like a big thriller or even a sort of a really Jim Jarmusch-y sort of thing, like the dryness of the score offsetting the emptiness of the movie. I don't know.
Well, I mean, they were setting out to make a noir, right? Which
feels like it.
Why not embrace that? Why don't you go more like Bernard Herrmann, like, or something, you know? I don't know.
Cape Fear horns, that kind of thing.
What?
The Cape Fear horns.
Yeah, that kind of thing. I mean, that could have been really, would have been very different, and it would have maybe not worked so much with the cinematography that you already have. But I don't know if they had embraced that a little bit more, because that's what Brady Snell's wrote. He wrote a modern noir. There's a spy in it, you know?
Yeah, it's true.
There's a murder, which we haven't even talked about.
Yeah. How do you even address the murder? It happens.
It happens.
It's clearly there for a reason.
It seems like the least important part of the movie.
Yeah, it really does. It's just not crucial to anyone else's life. And maybe that's the point. Like, it's Brady Stanella is just going, why not? It would happen.
I think he's trying to anchor the narrative, you know, on that, which doesn't work. It's not about the murder. It's not about what happened. It's sort of like a failed device, I think, that he's trying to employ. And Schrader certainly doesn't care about it that much.
Yeah, no, it kind of blows past it.
He totally blows past it. It takes 30 seconds and then we've moved on.
Yeah.
And you're like, I don't even know why that happened. There's no reason for that to happen.
Cost of doing business. I mean, maybe that's it. Some kind of weird commentary.
Marketing?
Yeah, I don't know.
Cost of doing business, right.
We need somebody to, we need something sexy murdery in the last reel. Let's do that.
Right?
Yeah.
It doesn't, but, you know, seeing as that's what it was supposed to be, you would sort of think like that more care would have been taken with like that device, the spying person who's just like wearing a backwards baseball cap and like baggy jeans and looks like he's out of like a weird 90s movie, who is like no place in this movie at all, and it's just following them around like on his flip phone, which why do they all have flip phones?
Yeah, I remember the one thing that struck me was like, is this supposed to be a reference to Loewen's past? Is this something about how she was really popular in that era when people looked like that?
I think really reading it into
much. Exactly, it doesn't go anywhere, but there's no evidence against it either because it's just there. You're right. None of it makes any real sense.
Yeah. But that's, again, like, that is what I find so incredible about it. Because you have these people that are individually just, like, masters or were masters at a certain point. And they're just like making these decisions that just don't, you know, totally check out. And yet at the end, you have this result that says something different than what they had intended, I believe. But it certainly, like, for me, resonates on so many levels.
Right. You want to understand it better.
I want to understand it better. And really, until, you know, we had made plans to do this, I always was saying to people how much I loved it. And I could never really articulate why. It was just one of those movies. I was like, I don't know why, but I just love it. I love Lindsay Lohan. I love, you know, and I love James Dean. And I just couldn't figure out, like, the confluence of things that made it good. So I'm grateful for this.
Yes, so now we've wrestled through it.
Yeah.
I am happy to help.
Yeah.
That's what I do. But yeah, to that end that we've broken it down and put it back together again as best we can, is there anything from the Canyons that you yourself have used or borrowed or stolen or lifted, something aesthetic, something in performance in your own work?
Oh. Huh, that's a good question.
I am endlessly fascinated by this. This is why the podcast exists.
Yeah. I think... I mean, it's interesting because I definitely sense that you dislike the movie.
I don't care for it. Yeah. I did not care for it. I mean, I've seen it twice. It means that there's something to it.
Right.
But, yeah, no, I'm not... It's not the first thing I would point to in the Schrader canon of stuff that you absolutely have to see.
Right,
but,
right.
But, you know, having talked about it for an hour, yeah, I kind of want to see it again.
And, you know, I read... I was trying to look for positive reviews because it's got 22% on Rotten Tomatoes, I think.
But some people liked it. I remember there were a couple of positive reviews.
Some people liked it. I was just looking for it. Richard Brody really liked it.
Okay.
And then, you know, a couple other people, I can't remember who, but not very many liked it. And, you know, it really made me... because. After a certain point of people, like, telling you that they don't like something that you like, you start to wonder.
Sure, yeah.
You're like, am I, like, is it really bad? Sure. Like, what is it, you know, am I mistaken? And I had to really kind of stop myself from doing that and just be like, no, I love it, and I'm gonna, like, try to figure out why. And the thing that I think I've taken from it, or maybe it's not that I've taken it from this movie, it's more that it's something I've already been doing that I see being done in that film that I enjoy, is just there's a bleakness to the world. It's not really about plot. It's not even really about the characters. It's just about the world, the view, this view of the world in a certain way. And there's this bleakness to it that I think resonates with me. I'm not a pessimistic person in my life, or at least I try not to be via, like, a decade of therapy. But I think I'm quite pessimistic in the art that I create. And I'm interested in quote-unquote unlikable characters, people that I would never want to spend time with in real life. I enjoy writing characters like that. And I enjoy spending time with them on the page or on screen. And that movie really does that well. And there's also, like, a very unromantic way of looking at sex.
Yeah.
That I'm interested in. And sort of, even though you have literal porn stars and, like, a, you know, a person like Lindsay Lohan who's been on Playboy, you know, you see them having sex, and yet there's nothing less sexy than watching them together.
Right.
It's off-putting, it's cringeworthy, you don't want to watch. And I find that really interesting.
Yeah, this is the thing you're supposed to want. We're going to make it as unpleasant and awkward and incongruous as possible.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that's kind of what I'm striving to do. I think... I try to be a bit more intentional with my humor in my work, because The Canyons is funny, but not on purpose.
Right, you want to communicate that more clearly.
Yeah, I think that there has to just be, like, a little bit more self-awareness, you know?
Yeah. I mean, your short film is about a young woman figuring out what she does and doesn't want from the world, right? I mean, that's very much in conversation with this.
Yeah.
I was struck by it just at the festival, just thinking, oh yeah, okay, people are talking about this without words. People, you know, like it's a how can I put it? It's an experiential portrait of someone finding out who she is ultimately, right? I mean, that's what it is on the surface, and then the deeper you go, the more there is to it, because that's how people are.
Yeah.
And the Kenyans kind of just says there is nowhere to go. There's just this surface that everybody's trapped in.
Yeah.
And these are the sacrifices they've made to become people who can thrive in that world.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think the Kenyans is more pessimistic than your stuff so far.
Yeah, I think you're right. But yeah. I think that is the part that draws me to it. It's this, like, very bleak view of the world, and it's the confluence of Bret Easton Ellis's way of dealing with, like, empty Hollywood, you know, vessels and traitor. But I think, yeah, I definitely try to have, I think the sense of humor is the thing that really, like, that I'm trying to cultivate that will set it apart a little bit from just being so dark.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I get the sense that your stuff will make me want to know why they are who they are.
Right.
As opposed to the Kenyans, which just says this is why they are.
Right, exactly. Yeah, totally.
Keeping the mystery alive.
Yeah, totally.
Well, thank you for that, because it makes movies more interesting.
Thank you.
My thanks to Sophia Banzaff, whose short film, I Am in the World as Free and Slender as a Deer on a Plane, is screening in Toronto this Sunday, January 26th at 4 p.m. at the TIFF Bell Lightbox. It's very good, and you should see it. Sophia will be there in everything. And keep an eye out for Black Conflux, coming to theaters later this spring. It's also very good. You can find Sophia on Twitter at Young Fifi, YungFiFi, all one word, and you can find The Kenyans on Blu-ray and DVD from Mongrel Media in Canada. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it, or the show in general, say so. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you've been enjoying us. Every little bit helps, it truly does. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network. They're pretty good. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening. See you next week.